This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I was just sitting on my couch, eating onion rings and watching TV, and I decided that it was time to get on my private jet and fly all the way up to Vancouver, right here, to the L-shaped studio in Hoholoon Plaza, to join my cohort, the Charlie Daniels of the Torque Wrench himself, Nick Duke. I, of course, am Greg Phillips, by the way. I think I forgot to mention that. How are you, Nick?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm just living the life here in my trailer park. So, well, not here, obviously, because here is in the studio, as mentioned a moment ago. The trailer park that I will then go to at a later time.
Now, do you have you a queen of your double-wide trailer yet?
No, not yet. Nope, still working on that. Still working on that. She ran off with this guy named Earl. So,
well, I would suggest checking the local park benches for said Earl.
Good point. Now, is this the same Earl that the Dixie Chicks would write about later on, I wonder?
I would have to assume. I like to assume that it's all in the country lyric universe, set in the same same universe.
Maybe we need to have the CLU corner.
That would be awesome. Studio. No one would care but us, and it would be fantastic.
So, Nick, tell everybody the story about how Marty Robbins has his later song, El Paso City, references his original song of El Paso.
Yes, in both songs, he is singing from the perspective of a character. In the original El Paso, he is singing from the perspective of a cowboy who is in love with this this Mexican lady, and some things go down, and basically he winds up dying at the end of the song as a result of his
situation. Spoiler alert!
His love gets him into. Anyway, the song El Paso City is sung from the perspective of a man who is visiting El Paso in what was then the modern times in like the 70s, begins to have flashbacks to the original song as if he is the reincarnated version of the cowboy from the original song. It's essentially like it's essentially a multiverse time travel kind of deal in a country song. It's really incredible.
Very predictive of where pop culture would go later on, a mixing and merging. Marty Robbins ahead of his time in many ways, but we're also ahead of our time, folks. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, as mentioned, the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
I got tired of that.
And we are here to present to you yet another episode of Spider Month. We're actually bringing things to a close this week, ladies and gentlemen, of Spider Month. But what we usually do is we lead off with whatever our lead topic of the show is. But as you may know, over the weekend was San Diego Comic-Con, and this, perhaps you would agree, Nick, was a particularly noteworthy San Diego Comic-Con, perhaps one of the more noteworthy Comic-Cons in some time.
Yeah, I would agree. As we'll discuss, that a lot of that was due to the fact that Marvel Studios had stopped announcing projects a couple of years ago because they wanted all the focus to be on their build to first Infinity War and then Endgame. And so we had no official confirmation of what the post-Endgame MCU was really going to look like until this weekend. So add that in to an already normally loaded weekend with Comic-Con happening and your standard new title announcements, trailer drops, and various other confirmations that we always get. And it just became one of the most newsworthy Comic-Cons in my memory, for sure.
Well, without that, without any further ado, we're going to lead off this episode with the rundown.
Welcome to the rundown.
It's our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics, and we just thought there were so many topics to tackle. It's so noteworthy and newsworthy that we needed to just we can just delve right in. And obviously the lead story this week, the story that everyone's talking about, was the Marvel Studios panel at Comic-Con. They unveiled a multitude of things, including their next schedule of films. Phase 4, I believe, Nick, is that correct?
That appears to be the case. Kevin Feige said this is Phase 4, a little bit of a shorter phase, but not really, because while it's shorter in length of time, the actual volume of content produced will be much greater because of the creation of the Disney Plus streaming service. And so we're going to get multiple television series that will now be firmly set in the MCU. No more Netflix approach, no more Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. approach where you have to sit there and hem and haw and wonder whether or not these shows actually fit into the larger MCU. Kevin Feige is making a point to say these are included in the main timeline, they're featuring the stars you're going to see in the movies, and in some cases, movies are going to directly tie into or pick right up, you know, immediately before or immediately after a television series that is planned for Disney Plus. So lots of exciting announcements.
And what I'm going to do in the interest of transparency is the good folks at Newsarama have compiled a list of all the announcements that were made.
Oh, I thought you were going to have me do this.
I changed my mind.
You changed your mind. Well, then, real quick, then, if we're going to go in chronological order, which I think the Newsarama thing is structured
well,
that way.
They're it's not exactly, because they have Black Widow at the bottom of the list. So
yeah, well, I mean chronologically in terms of like the panel itself, like the way
they were announced
during the panel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can do it then. Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin Feige actually led off the panel, making the formal announcement that Avengers Endgame has passed Avatar as the number one grossing film of all time worldwide at the box office. That was a great way to kind of. He took the moment to say thank you to the fans that were in attendance for the support they had been given over the years. And, yeah, so big news there as Avengers is now officially the all-time global box office champion.
Very good news. And all of us who went to see the movie multiple times can pat ourselves on our fat backs.
Hovering right around $2.8 billion is what it looks like, which is just ahead of Avatar's $2.789. So, massive worldwide take for that Endgame. But anyway, continue on now.
Very good. Well, we're going to go on the Newsarama article based on the timeline of the announcements rather than the actual chronological timeline of releases. First up, they announced The Eternals, which we already knew about. However, we got some news about the cast, including Richard Madden as Icarus, Kumail Nanjiani as Kingo, Lauren Ridloff as Makari, Brian Tyree Henry as Phaistos, Salma Hayek as Ajak, Leah McHugh as Sprite, Don Lee as Gilgamesh, and Angelina Jolie as Thena. I don't know what any of these characters are or mean, but I'm excited because the MCU has not gone astray yet, Nick. So I'm not excited about this one per se, but I'm sure that once the first trailer comes out, it'll capture my attention.
Yeah, that's kind of the same way I am. This is the one that's most like Guardians of the Galaxy, because if you remember a few years ago, I don't mean in terms of tone, I mean in terms of how I'm approaching it as a fan. When the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie came out in 2014, Greg, I think that's right, you and I both, we had no idea what to expect because we knew nothing about the characters. We had not yet delved into the DNA run of comics that we would later review. We were kind of going in blind, and this is kind of the same thing. Now, I'm not expecting this to be as much fun, for lack of a better term. Probably not going to have the same tone as Guardians, but I'm kind of an open book with this. This can be anything that they want to turn it into, and as long as the final product is good, I'm probably willing to go in there, you know, and follow them anywhere, because I have no preconceived notions of what it is. I will say, they already released one piece of concept art that showed some Celestials walking across a plane, and it looks phenomenal, the piece of concept art I saw.
Very good. That's good to hear.
Yeah, I know you're particularly excited about the character of Ajak being adapted on screen.
Yes, yes. Ajak is a character, as you know, Nick, that I've talked about a lot over the years. Mm-hmm. A character that was really important to my formative years of comics and still is to this day. Mm-hmm. Now, I will grant you that I don't actually know anything about the character of Ajak. I'm not even sure that I'm pronouncing it correctly. However, I do know that character is played by Salma Hayek, and she played a very valuable role in the process of me growing up and becoming the man that we all know today.
Angelina Jolie didn't?
Oh, she did. She did as well.
What was that movie she did where it was, had a bunch of bone in it?
Oh my gosh, Original Sin.
Original Sin, there you go. That's what
fantastic.
I'm talking about, yep.
Actually, she probably had more to do with it than Salma back then, but Salma has aged like a fine wine.
There you go.
Much like, who would be a male equivalent? Clint Howard. Not a good example. She's done awesome. And both of them together in movies, fantastic. Fantastic. 15-year-old me is jumping for joy.
Among other
also
things.
Some of these other names are good too. Kingo sounds like a New Japan wrestler.
Richard Madden, most people will know from Game of Thrones most recently as Ron Stark. That's a pretty big deal for him to be call up.
And I believe he's the son of John Madden, is that correct?
No, that is not correct at all.
Fair enough.
But in any event.
The next announcement that was made was Disney Plus, their first Marvel TV show that will be unveiled, which is The Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yes.
little bit of a long title, but it will follow the events of Avengers Endgame, in which Sam Wilson was given the mantle of Captain America. And Daniel Brühl will reprise his role as Zemo, including, based on a video that was sent to the Comic-Con panel, donning a version of his comic book costume, including the iconic mask.
The comic book traditional Zemo mask.
Yes. So this sounds awesome, Nick. I'm all in on this show. I love Sebastian Stan and Anthony Mackie. Love their chemistry together as bosom buddies, essentially. And throwing the excellent Zemo into the mix, who both of us are extremely high on in the pantheon of MCU villains.
Yeah, I believe he finished in our official top five, composite top five MCU villains for the Hard Travelers for Hire. So great to see him coming back. And I think you and I both have been clamoring for him to come back ever since. I kind of thought they would originally use him in some sort of Hannibal Lecter role, but it seems like this is going to be – he's going to be out and directly affecting Sam and Bucky. So this is very exciting.
What do you make of this being titled Falcon and the Winter Soldier instead of Captain America and the Winter Soldier
after
the events of Endgame?
I've kind of thought this for a little bit. I think part of the story of this will be Sam, you know, Sam will be Captain America in name, but I think part of the story will be him learning exactly what that means and him growing into the role and fully taking it on as his own. And Bucky probably having to, you know, come to terms with the fact that Steve is no longer around and that Sam is carrying the mantle, because in that moment he was okay with it, but it's another thing to be okay with it, you know, once shit hits the fan finally. So I think it's meant to represent that he's going to fully become Captain America in spirit by the end of the show. I think Sam will be the one who goes through the most transformative arc.
Good points all around. Next up, Feige and director Destin Daniel Cretton announced formally, I'm going to let Michael Buffer take this one over, Shang-Chi and the Master of the Diamond Cutter. That's not the title. It's Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings.
Yes.
Starring Sam Liu.
Is that how you pronounce that?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Tony Leung as the, or that might be Tony Leung, I'm not sure, as the real Mandarin. Somebody named Awkwafina will also appear in the film.
Yeah, she was in that, what's that movie that everybody's obsessed, or was, about the Asians. I say that, that's not meant to be offensive. Asians is actually in the title.
Crazy Rich Asians.
Say Pretty Rich Asians. Crazy Rich Asians. That's it. She's in that. So people know her from that. She was also in that the Netflix film that came out, the rom-com recently.
I recognize her. Yeah, okay.
Always,
commercials.
Always Be My Maybe, I think it's called.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, she's still budding, you know, budding star, but is starting to get more name recognition. So that's who that is, Awkwafina. And I believe she used to be a musician of some sort is why the single name.
Yes, the Legend of the Ten Rings, and Simu Liu, I think I'm pronouncing that right, Simu Liu.
You said Sam last time, so I'm not... I'm curious.
I thought you were talking about the Lou. I didn't realize I said Sam. No, it's not how. It's not Sam Lou. That's I said that because there's a guy that directs the DC animated movies whose name is Sam Lou.
It surely is. Yeah.
But no, this is I guess it's Simu Lou. And interestingly, he won this role apparently by social media campaigning for it. Like he just said, "Hey, why don't you make me Iron Fist?" And it happened.
No, Shang-Chi.
I'm sorry, Shang-Chi. Yeah, Iron Fist, Shang-Chi. Tony Rumble, I don't know. In any event, this guy's name, Simu Liu, he doesn't have a very extensive filmography of prominent roles. He says here he is best known for his role of Jung in the CBC television sitcom Kim's Convenience. He doesn't appear to have any martial arts films on his repertoire that I can tell, but hopefully, he deliver the kind. I should mention the reason that I am so excited about Shang-Chi is because I want to see an MCU martial arts film, and it's one of the reasons I'm tentative about it because I know they're actually going to embrace that as much. But hopefully, they do, and I'm hoping that he can deliver the sort of presence that I want out of it. But I'm excited for him. Excited for the cast. Tony Leung's great. So this should be a good one, Nick. I'm excited about this.
No thoughts on the real Mandarin making his appearance?
Well, we knew it was going to happen. I don't like it, but we knew it was going to happen. And so there's nothing I can do about it. I'm just going to accept it and give it a chance to wow me like I suspect that it might.
Do you think it'll be better in the context of an Asian-led superhero movie?
Yes, absolutely.
I would agree.
1,000%, yes.
Did you know? I did not know this. This is a true fact that I learned while reading articles about this Shang-Chi movie. Part of the reason they're using the Mandarin, do you know what Shang-Chi's most notable villain in the comics, what his name is?
Fu Manchu.
Mm-hmm. Even you thought the Mandarin was as bad as it could possibly get.
So let me tell you why I'm excited about Tony Leung's casting in this movie.
Yeah.
He is known for a lot. He's been in all kinds of greats. He was in Lust, Caution. Which I would recommend for reasons not to do with the plot. He was in The Grandmaster, which is a great martial arts film, and
you would recommend for reasons due to wrestling with the plot.
Indeed. He has also been in the Academy Award nominated movie Hero with Jet Li.
Oh, yeah.
And for my purposes, most notably, the fantastic Hong Kong action masterpiece, Infernal Affairs and Hard-Boiled.
Hard-Boiled, yeah.
Hard-Boiled is, of course, the John Woo masterpiece. So Tony Leung's awesome, and he's going to add a lot of gravitas to the Mandarin.
Absolutely. This is exciting. I'm pumped for it. Yeah, more variety in the MCU. More subgenres to explore, because I think they can. I personally think they will lean into the martial arts thing, just because I think it's they've done a pretty good job of trying to differentiate these films, at least the solo films thus far. I think it'll be fine.
The next announcement was WandaVision, another Disney Plus show that will reunite Wanda Maximoff and oh my gosh, Newsarama, really. It will reunite Elizabeth Olsen as Wanda Maximoff, the Scarlet Witch, along with Paul Bettany as the Vision. They said reunite Wanda Maximoff as Scarlet Witch, yeah, with Paul Bettany as Vision. Anyway, alongside Tiana Paris, who will portray the adult version of Monica Rambeau in this show, which takes place after Avengers Endgame. So there was some speculation about when this show would take place, Nick. Mm-hmm. We thought maybe it would tell the story of how they... But adult Monica's cool too, so this should be a great show.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. What do you have a theory as to how they're going to work in Vision? Because I have one.
No, I hadn't really thought about it.
I'm assuming, based on another property that we will discuss here in a little bit, that Wanda will in her grief have been tapping into her powers to access alternate realities, and that will be their method of bringing Paul Bettany back, and it will turn out that she's been living in this essentially unrealistic, you know, this fantasy world that she has created for herself. That's my official prediction.
Yes, I do think that this show will be a chance for them to expand her powers a little, and some were kind of hinted at in Endgame, but I think we'll get to see some of the nonsensical comic book powers, reality warping and hexes and all that stuff, so that's going to be fun. The next one announced was Loki, which we already knew about, and it will also follow Avengers Endgame. Where did Loki go when he took the Space Stone? That's the big question. No release date was announced for this one. Thoughts?
Oh, I'm pumped for this. As you know, anytime we can get more time with Loki, this is always the best. I'm very much looking forward to this. No formal release date was announced, but I'm pretty sure they had this dated as part of their 2021 slate of Disney Plus shows. So I think we know this is coming in 2021.
Next up, Kevin Feige brought out director Scott Derrickson to discuss the Doctor Strange sequel, which officially has its new subtitle, or its new title, really, not subtitle, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
What an awesome title, for me anyway. I love that title.
And it will purportedly be the first, quote, scary movie in the MCU. Elizabeth Olsen as Wanda Maximoff will also star in this movie. Or appear in this movie. So, thus lending credence to your theory, Nick.
Yes,
that is... Germans love David Hasselhoff.
Germans love David Hasselhoff. No, this is very exciting. The title is reminiscent of like an H.P. Lovecraft story or something like that. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Well, it's directly meant to reference the Lovecraft.
Right, I said it's reminiscent. I mean, it's not like... What are we debating here?
Oh, reminiscent. Reminiscent is like, oh, that's similar to it, but it's the same title. It's just the word change, but that's all right.
And then I also think that one's at the. So there's two word changes, so yeah. While you're trying to be a prick for prick's sake. Anyway, no, this is.
Oh, this the is shoes exciting. On the other toe.
The shoes on the other toe. No, this is very exciting. Plus, the indication they're going to be multiverse hopping throughout the film, you know, universe hopping. Makes it seem like they're going to double down on the aspects that made the second half of Doctor Strange so entertaining rather than focusing on the aspects that made the first half more of a slog to get through. So this is, it seems like, you know, based on what little we know, that classic thing of accentuating the strengths while hiding the weaknesses. So I'm pumped for this.
As you know, I consider Doctor Strange the worst MCU movie. So I can't say I'm pumped for this, but I always knew that I thought the sequel to Doctor Strange had potential to be much better than the first one because they get all the origin crap out of the way. So I am excited for it, actually. And there is that element of me that is like, wow, how cool a multiverse. And it made me realize, Nick, that Marvel has already beaten DC Film to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
They have beaten DC Film to a Justice League movie.
Mm-hmm.
They have beaten DC Film... to
legacy characters. Yep.
And now they have beaten DC, the company that invented the multiverse, to a multiverse movie.
is that surprising to you in any way?
No.
I'm still convinced
they're just TV actors, though.
And, you know, as much as we have seen Guardians of the Galaxy and said, "Oh my God, they beat them to a Green Lantern movie," and then we saw Captain Marvel, we said, "God." They beat them to a Green Lantern
movie. Another Green Lantern movie.
We're going to see a Nova movie before we see a Green Lantern movie. And we're going to go, good God, they definitely beat them to a Green Lantern movie now.
Oh, Lord. It's true. All right. The next project that was announced, both of us are stoked for, but we have to wait so long, Nick. The previously announced animated show, What If, will feature Jeffrey Wright as the Watcher. That's perfect. Oh, I love it. I didn't even see that announcement until just now, Nick. With various MCU actors reprising their roles. It will premiere on Disney Plus in the summer of 2021. So we got a 2-year wait on this one. That sucks. But how great does this show look?
Oh, it looks awesome. I actually have the teaser image that has some of the voice cast that is coming back from the MCU to do this animated series. I'm going to read them off real quick for you. Michael B. Jordan, Sebastian Stan, Josh Brolin, Mark Ruffalo, Tom Hiddleston, Samuel L. Jackson, Chris Hemsworth, Haley Atwell, Chadwick Boseman, Karen Gillan, Jeremy Renner, Paul Rudd, Michael Douglas. Neil McDonough, Dominic Cooper, Sean Gunn, Natalie Portman, David Dasmalchian, Stanley Tucci, Taika Waititi, Toby Jones, Jamin Hansu, Goldblum, Michael Rooker, and Chris Sullivan, all returning to reprise their roles at some point in some form or another.
Gosh, they're gonna do a what if the Watcher, or not the Watcher? Well, what if what is Goldblum's character's name again?
The Grandmaster.
The Grandmaster hadn't been overthrown at the Ragnarok.
Like, just looking at these, that means standing out to me immediately, more Yondu, because Michael Rooker is involved.
Mm-hmm.
More of Dr. Abraham Erskine, because of Stanley Tucci's involvement. If you remember, he was a standout character in the first Captain America movie. Neil McDonough as Dum Dum Dugan is back. I mean, this is exciting. It seems like everyone's involved. Notably, though, no Chris Evans or EJ listed on this voice cast. Not to say they won't be there, but they're not listed on this initial announcement.
Quite interesting. Because I think I thought that maybe one of the what ifs would be, well, I guess it wouldn't really be a what if then. At some point, I believe they might go back and tell that story of Cap going through the timeline, but maybe not.
Two of the ones that have been confirmed already are, what if Peggy Carter got the Super Soldier Serum, and what if Thor went for the head in Infinity War?
I like that. Especially that second one is interesting. Very interesting.
Both are very interesting. But
well, the Peggy one, I think, I guess I wonder how much things would have really changed, you know, like, but from one to the other. But I guess we'll see how they play it out in the form of the television show.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I'm really excited about, of all of these TV projects, the one I'm most excited about was announced next, and that is Hawkeye, featuring Jeremy Renner in a show that they confirmed will also feature Kate Bishop. It will premiere also in 2021, in the fall. The reason that I'm excited for this, Nick, has nothing to do with the cast, has nothing to do with anything. It has to do with the logo.
Yep.
Now, the logo they're using for this is right out of the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run.
Now, to be fair, though, given the interpretation of Hawkeye we've seen thus far in the MCU, don't you think it's unlikely that we're going to – I don't think he'll be acting like the Hawkeye from – or the Clint Barton from the Fraction run, because rather than being down on his luck and perpetually – you know, unlucky, he's kind of, everything's going for him right now. He's got his family back. He should be living his best life, you would think.
Maybe it's a multiversal Hawkeye.
Maybe it is.
I don't know. I'm hoping that the show has that tone, personally. That's what I'm interested in seeing. So they've elevated my hopes, and I hope they deliver on that, because it could be really, really good. Anybody that hasn't read Matt Fraction's Hawkeye, go do it. It's great. The next announcement, Thor 4 has been confirmed with the title Thor, Love and Thunder from director Taika Waititi. Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson will reprise their roles as Thor and Valkyrie with Natalie Portman. This was the shocking announcement of the panel, really. Mm-hmm. One of two. The first shocking announcement. Natalie Portman will return as Jane Foster, but that's not the shock. The shock is that she will return as Jane Foster to become Thor, as in the Jane Aaron comic books.
I think both are pretty shocking, both the inclusion of female Thor and the inclusion of Natalie Portman, because she had flat out said she was done, you know, that she didn't have any interest in coming back. And
I think word spreads fast in Hollywood, and everybody apparently had such a good time making Ragnarok. I think that word spread, because by most indications that I can tell, people did not enjoy the making of Thor 2 at all.
Well, they changed directors like three times, and the movie, it was one of those MCU movies, like, you know, as we've discussed, there's no bad MCU movie. Let's get that out of the way first. But
right,
it's the one that, if you follow the development of them, seemingly was made the most like a DC movie in terms of constant onset rewrites, nobody really knowing what they were supposed to be doing, and it led to tension, and just, it was easily the most discombobulated Marvel production, based on reports, anyway.
It was a movie where Hemsworth was on record talking about, after that movie, that he was pretty much ready to walk away until he got a chance to work with Taika Waititi on Ragnarok. So perhaps word spread to Natalie Portman and made her think, hey, this could actually be fun to do. Now, what's interesting that I love the sort of He-Man font they're going with here too. But the it's interesting how they're going to get there, because this Jane Foster is a much different character than the one that we're familiar with in the Thor comics, at least to my knowledge. Nick, would you agree?
Yeah, for the most part, I would. In the comics, Jane Foster is a nurse. She's not a astrophysicist or whatever. And in those comics, part of the story is she has developed terminal cancer and has to come to terms with the fact that, you know, she has to say goodbye. And it is through this process of kind of giving up her sense of ego that she becomes worthy of lifting Mjolnir. Mjolnir brings her, transports her magically to the moon, and she is able to lift the hammer there. So,
do you suspect that this version of Jane will also be a result of the multiversal deal?
I'm thinking so. I think that'll be an easy way for them to just bring in a version of Jane that is just completely divorced from the previous version, which, as we've all discussed, is one of the lesser regarded characters in the MCU. I don't think anybody's really clamoring for a return of that character. But then again, maybe they'll use that character, and Taika Waititi did what he did in Ragnarok and just have her act like a different character and not really explain
it. There it is.
That's not a shot! I mean, he did do that. That's what he did. It's fine.
So how do you feel about the Taika Waititi residue on the Thor universe?
I mean, we've talked about this a couple weeks ago. Everybody loved Ragnarok. I mean, I was expecting it. It's not unexpected. I will say, after mulling it over a little bit, this one being titled Love and Thunder and not something like, oh, the God Butcher or
the Death of Superman
or the Asgardian Wars or something that is indicative of a great classic Thor story, that puts me at ease a bit more, just because this way, you know, walking in, I know it's going to be its own, you know, goofy thing rather than this alleged adaptation of a classic Thor story that it doesn't really adapt.
Well, I understand that for his next project, he's going to attempt to do a faithful adaptation of V for Vendetta.
Oh,
so
awesome.
That should be interesting.
That should be fun. Natalie Portman can come back and do that again.
She would play Evie. That's right. She was in Evie the first one. My God.
That was the joke.
Yes, I forgot all about that. It's just been, that was 2007. Wow.
Get Jeff Goldblum to play V.
Oh, my God. I kind of want it now. I just imagine him delivering all those V lines, you know, the V words, vivisected and all that stuff.
You've read the book, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And have you tried watching the movie since you read the book?
I can't remember, honestly.
I used to love the movie, and then I read the book, and then I tried to watch the movie, and I was like, it's one of those things where it has impacted my enjoyment of the movie, because the way V is written in the comic is so ambiguous.
It's very different,
Like, so, you are intentionally not supposed to know whether you're supposed to, like, empathize with this guy or be on board with the actions he takes in support of his ideals. And in the movie, they kind of make him more of, like, a generic freedom fighter. And
anti-hero,
It's very, very difficult to reconcile those two.
It's different. I can still enjoy the movie because, like, I look at it independent thing and still can enjoy it, but it certainly doesn't – it is a completely different work than the book, completely different in terms of the characters the same, some of the lines are the same.
But a lot of the nuance is gone.
But the nuance and the ambiguity, I think you hit the nail on the head with that, the ambiguity of the book – is completely gone, because the movie is trying to tell a 1984.
V is the hero of the movie. There's no V and Evie. You know,
it is essentially a modern retelling of 1984. The book is much more cynical in the way that it looks at political rivalries. I'll say, and what happens to Evie in the book is far worse than what happens to her movie.
It's brutal.
But I don't know how we got on that. But it was all good points. Go read the book, V for Vendetta. It's great. Black Widow is a movie that we knew was going to happen. It's going to be our actual next journey in the MCU. That is slated for a May 1, 2020 release. Feige was joined on stage by someone, but they showed off early footage from the film, including a look at a skull-faced Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan. Ooh. The most dangerous foe of them all. And Scarlett Johansson will be back as Natasha Romanoff, David Harbour as the Red Guardian. Florence Pugh, who played Paige, I believe, in that WWE movie, will be playing Yelena, the other Black Widow. Mm-hmm. And O.T. Fagbinle will be Mason, and Rachel Wise will be Melina. You know, Melina riding, of course, on the success of her appearance at the Raw reunion Monday night. And what do you make of the bold decision to put 5'1" Kevin Sullivan as the primary villain in a Marvel movie?
I didn't see that they did that.
Yeah, the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan.
Taskmaster, my lord. Anyway, this is very exciting. This cast is awesome. I know you haven't seen any Stranger Things, but David Harbour, he's a great actor. That Hellboy notwithstanding, I haven't seen Hellboy. I have no intention of seeing Hellboy, but he's great in Stranger Things. I'm excited for him to get a bigger role here. Florence Pugh seems like she's on the cusp of a big breakout role and possibly can mm-hmm. be set up for a future appearances as this other Black Widow. And then Rachel Wise is awesome casting as well. So this is exciting. Most notably, they have not revealed who Taskmaster is, so naturally people are expecting it to be, you know, some sort of mysterious reveal at some point in the movie, possibly. I've already read one speculatory piece suggesting that Rachel Wise herself might be playing Taskmaster.
Could be. The other thing that is exciting about this movie, very exciting, is that Scarlett Johansson has said that it's the most fight scenes that she's ever filmed in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty, for an action head like me, that's pretty exciting.
And I think she compared the tone, most notably, she said it was closest to that of the Winter Soldier. So as everyone knows, pre-Endgame, Greg and I both had Winter Soldier as either like our number one or number two Marvel movie, depending on which day you caught us. And so to hear that one is coming more in that vein is very exciting. And yeah, I'm pumped for this. The May Marvel release has generally speaking been their flagship release, the one that they are putting all the hype machine behind. And it wasn't that long ago that, you know, them doing a Black Widow movie in that slot seemed unthinkable. But yet it's in that slot now, and it kind of makes sense. I'm pumped for it.
Mm-hmm. And the final announcement was a huge surprise. Nobody saw this coming, Nick,
no.
Including the hard traveling fanboys.
This had not been rumored. This was genuinely like just a how they kept this quiet. I have no idea, but here it is.
Well, it turns out that Mabel was the third man. No, that's not the announcement here. The announcement was that Feige brought out the actor Mahershala Ali. I just learned this weekend, Nick, that we've been pronouncing it wrong on this show for the better part of two
Mahershala?
Years. Mahershala? That's how he said it in the presser.
I like our pronunciation better.
Mahershala Ali was brought out, and he unveiled a hat that revealed that he will be playing Blade, the vampire hunter, in a Marvel Studios film. No official release date given for this, I believe, Nick?
Correct. Kevin Feige later said that would be part of Phase 5 of the Marvel Universe, which will be taking place no sooner than 2022. So, Phase 5 already getting loaded. We don't have any release dates for it, but as Greg will mention in a moment, we'll talk about Mahershala first, and then talk about the other things that were teased for Phase 5 before we wrap up this MCU panel. But, yeah, this is exciting. You and I have been blown away by him in virtually anything
he is fantastic.
Yeah, seen or heard him in, whether that's Luke Cage, whether that's Into the Spider-Verse. He's been great in everything. So this is awesome. And it's even more awesome when you consider the news that broke about how it all came together, in that he won an Oscar and then just called up Marvel and said, "Hey, I'd like to do this." And Kevin Feige was like, "Well, how do you say no to that?" And so they had no intention of doing Blade, but thanks to his interest, Blade was added to the slate.
Do you think they go R with it?
Oh, man, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see what else they announce in 2020 for Phase 5. I think there is a possibility that we see a Deadpool movie in Phase 5, and if that's the case, then yes. I think if they're going to make that jump, I think it's possible. But I don't know. Blade's not like Deadpool, to me anyway. I don't think it is 100% necessary. Maybe you disagree.
It's mostly yes. Mostly I disagree. Because when you're dealing with vampires and blood, you're going to hit a quota pretty quick if you go PG-13. And I don't want to see it sanitized. So, yeah, I want to see it be an R. I think it's a property that warrants it, especially when it is living off the legacy of the pre-movies. So, you know, I believe it is necessary to do it. Not that it can't be a good movie without it. It can. But it's like we've talked about, you know, we've talked about this with PG has not been the problem with WWE's product. But would it help if they didn't have such corny insults for each other? Probably.
Yeah.
So... You know, I think it's not necessary, but it's more necessary than it will be for most characters. I would say the same, by the way, if they ever do a Wolverine solo movie.
That's true, but we did see a really good Wolverine solo movie that was PG-13.
PG-13, yes. They released an R cut of it, but right. Yeah. I agree. But yeah, so Blade is super exciting. But before he left, he also said that they didn't even have time to
Kevin
get
Feige,
to...
this is, yeah.
Captain pronouns, Marvel, pronouns, pal. Captain Marvel 2, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Black Panther 2. We knew all these were happening. There's no question about it that all these movies are happening. I'll be honest with you, Nick. I am very surprised that Black Panther 2 is not listed in 2020 or 2021. Very surprised. Because that's going to end up put. If let's be aggressive as we possibly can, and let's go. It's going to be announced for 2022. Mm-hmm. That will have been 5 years between the first one and the sequel.
Very true. I think part of that could be scheduling, perhaps, because I think the cast that is involved in Black Panther has each of them in their own right have kind of become like Danny Garay, a star, you know? Mm-hmm. Chadwick Boseman is a big star. Michael B. Jordan, who is alleged to be returning in some way, shape, form, or fashion, not sure what that's going to take. He's a big star. I wonder if perhaps shifting schedules didn't have something to do with that.
Perhaps. And I think it's 4 years, actually. Because didn't Black Panther come out in 2018?
Came out last year. Yeah, right before. It was the last one before Infinity War, right?
So if it's 2022, it would be 4 years between movies. So that's not as bad. But I'm a little surprised by that. But you're right. The schedules of these people. And they don't want to do it without any of these. Particularly the director, Steve... Ryan Coogler. Steve Coogan. Yeah. Steve Coogan's totally different guy.
That would be awesome. But yeah, and then of course he did say, hey, it's Fantastic Four and...
Fantastic Four and, quote, mutants.
Yep.
No more mutants!
Which, I've started thinking about that. Initially, we were wondering if that might be a replacement term for X-Men, but perhaps he said mutants as a stand-in term for multiple X-related properties, which would, you know, that purview, you could have both X-Men and Deadpool, which is kind of where I'm leaning at this point.
Mutants. So Fantastic Four is going to happen. We're going to get some kind of X properties in probably next year's SDCC announcements, maybe.
Yeah. Not mentioned, however, were an Ant-Man 3 or a third Spider-Man movie, although later reports indicated that Sony is fully responsible for the marketing of the Spider-Man films, so if a Spider-Man release date is going to be announced, it will come from Sony and from Marvel Studios.
Did Sony not have a presence at SDCC?
I do not believe so, no.
Yeah, because we didn't get anything about Venom.
No Venom, no Morbius, no Silver and Black, none of those other alleged movies they're working on.
Kraven.
Is that? Oh, yeah.
I don't think that's even rumored anymore, actually. But.
Wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, so there you are.
Loaded weekend of activities. But that's not all, because that's all for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now we're finally ready to get to the rest of the rundown topics.
Yeah.
Well, let's stick with Marvel and with something that is purported to be connected to the MCU, or was at one time purported.
Not anymore.
To the MCU. Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Is finally coming to an end. The announcement was made that that next summer's seventh season will be its last. Now, a lot of people have been very high on recent seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I've been watching after season 2 or 3, whichever one introduced the gimmick where Sky was revealed to be Quake, the Inhuman. And then they went to Inhumans planet and all that stuff. I checked out after that, but they say it got better from there. I'll never find out, quite honestly. But this show's coming to an end. 7 years, not a bad run for a show, Nick.
No, it's not. It's very, you know, it's a good run. I don't watch the show. I have no intention of ever really catching up on the show, despite how good people say it got. But for fans who enjoyed it, I mean, you really can't ask for much more than 7 years. Arrow, even in its low points, I think is generally more well-regarded than Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is in the fan community. And it only got 8 seasons. So to get 7 out of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is pretty remarkable.
Very, very good, yeah. And the other thing that I realized, 7 seasons on a major network like ABC, right. Granted, being batted around time slots and all that stuff, but to survive on a major network like that is quite impressive.
And they've had to do the will they or won't they be canceled dance pretty much every season, it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
To go ahead and say, all right, we know we're getting this season that's coming up and another one, and then we're walking away, gives you an opportunity to end it on your terms rather than having a Justice League-like situation where, you know, if you remember the producers, that kind of mm-hmm. got canceled unexpectedly. They didn't know that it was all happening or going down that way. So there you are.
Absolutely. So for fans of that, hopefully you get to enjoy the rest of the ride and take it to the end there. The other thing, before we get to the next topic, Nick, I was doing some cursory research this past week. I was curious about if any comic book shows have won any Emmy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to guess? Now, I could be wrong on this, but from what I was gathering, what the only comic book show that I could find that has won an Emmy Award from recent memory of the modern era of comic book shows starting like 2010?
Let me think. Riverdale?
Actually, I didn't include Riverdale. I'll say superhero shows. Let's limit it to that.
Okay. Trying to think.
First one, please let me know, folks, on Twitter.
Cloak and Dagger.
Wrong.
What is it?
It was actually Gotham.
Oh, God.
Gotham won an Emmy Award.
Set design?
For set design, yep. Or special effects or something,
yep.
Like that.
Yep. I that's one thing I will say. As much as I hate the show, the sets are really good. We're really good on the first season of Gotham from what I saw.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the exact awards were. Never mind, I can't pull it up now. But anyway, it just struck me as like that's about right. So yeah, for the episode That's Entertainment, they won for Outstanding Special Visual Effects.
Mm.
Anyway, let's move on to DC Television, actually, which, appropriately enough, they had their own panel, Nick, and it was also filled with news items, right? So the first of those being Brandon Routh, who has come to fame as recently as playing Ray Palmer, the Atom, on DC's Legends of Tomorrow, was on the DC TV panel, and he stood up at one point when they're talking about Crisis on Infinite Earths, and he ripped open his shirt to reveal underneath the Kingdom Come Superman shirt. So Brandon Routh, who once played the Man of Steel in the 2006 film Superman Returns, will be playing a different version of Clark Kent from Tyler Hoechlin, who will also be playing Clark Kent in the upcoming Mega Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover. How cool is this?
This is pretty awesome. Kingdom Come Superman is one of my favorite alternate versions of any character, really, in the DC universe. I've always had I love Kingdom Come. Such a great story. Cool to see that's going to be included. And then when you combine it with some of the other announcements that were made and also the rumors that are floating around out there about the scope of this Crisis crossover, my anticipation level and hype level for it just grows every day.
It's amazing. It makes one question how they're going to pull this off, but every announcement that comes off about it is just fantastic. And that's not the only one, Nick. We also found out that freaking Burt Ward
is
going to be part of this crossover.
This is amazing.
Burt Ward. For those of you who don't know, Burt Ward played Dick Grayson, a.k.a. Robin, in the original 1960s Batman TV series.
Yes.
This is phenomenal.
I don't know that he's playing this right. I hope he plays Earth 2 Robin, an older, like, just aged out Robin, an aged out version of Dick Grayson. And I hope they give us either, I'm not even lying, I would be fine with a hologram, a CGI recreation, or just straight up do it Roger Rabbit style and take the animated version from those Cape Crusader did and just drop Adam West in there somehow. Like, there at least has to be an Adam West nod, an homage of some sort.
I think there will be. I suspect that perhaps in this universe, Batman will be dead. And I'm going to be the only one left.
Oh, no. That'll be devastating.
Devastating. And do you want them to put Burt Ward in the Speedo again?
Yes.
Because I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to see how the baby's arm's holding up.
That's right. And it doesn't stop there, because another announcement about Crisis on Infinite Earths that is a cool one for comic book fans especially.
Real quick, Greg, one that I meant to find and to include in this that I didn't, that I read somewhere, and I don't even know if you knew this. They confirmed that Tom Cavanaugh is going to be playing the character Pariah from Crisis on Infinite Earths in this. So we do not know if he's playing a version of the Pariah character from Crisis on Infinite Earths, the comic, or my theory that I like even better, what if it's a version of Harrison Wells who inadvertently signaled for the Anti-Monitor to come to his universe?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can see that. I like that a lot, actually. That makes sense to me. Or is it possible that Pariah is Eobard Thawne?
That would be
inadvertently.
Or Harry, the guy, the one that went back. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. Maybe in attempts to get his intelligence back.
Yep.
Well, also, Entertainment Weekly reported Monday that actress Elizabeth Tulloch will reprise her role as Lois Lane in the Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover. And the big news out of this isn't she's going back. I think everybody thought that was going to happen. The big news is that when she returns, she will be a mother, and the crossover will include the debut of Lois and Clark's child, who everyone assumes will be John Kent from the comics. This is really cool, Nick. I'm a big John Kent fan, and I'm excited to see him make his big screen debut.
God, this is going to be awesome. Yeah, I mean, like I said, the longer we go towards this, the closer we get to it, the more excited I get. And then I hesitate to even talk about this, but I feel like we have to address the rumors that are also out there, unconfirmed at this point, but rumor would have you believe that both Tom Welling and Linda Carter are going to be reprising their roles as the Smallville version of Superman and the 1977 Wonder Woman, respectively.
Yes, those are rumors out there. We haven't seen them confirmed by a reputable source yet, but they're out there enough that they've gotten a lot of people excited. So I don't know that that's going to happen, but I kind of think it should.
It should. So. I mean, especially in the case of Linda Carter, who has already done work on the Arrowverse previously anyway, you know, because she's played the president on Supergirl. She has a pre-existing relationship. Tom Welling, I have no idea. I have no idea what he wants to do.
They could retroactively tie the Batman 66 and Wonder Woman 70s universes together,
yeah,
and just have her and Burt Ward show up as a unit, you know?
Absolutely.
Another bit of news from the world of television, DC television even, is that Heroes star Sindhil...
Oh, you skipped over one.
Did I?
You did.
Which one did I put?
The good one.
Oh, yes, finally, Nick's and my years-long nightmare is over, or at least one of our years-long nightmares. We have several. And that nightmare is the character of James Olsen on Supergirl, because Machad Brooks, who's a fine actor, a good man, is bidding farewell to Supergirl. James Olsen will be leaving the CW series in the first half of its upcoming season 5. No word on how he will exit, but they said they are leaving the door ajar for a cameo down the road. However, I hope there are none.
As do I.
Your reaction to this announcement?
Well, bye.
Oh.
Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. or do for all I care. I don't care. Get out.
This has been building a long time, and I'm giddy. About this departure.
He has been, without question, the worst character on that show
yes.
for some time.
Yes.
A corresponding move that I, again, forgot to include in this because there's so much news, is that Schott will be returning as a...
Yes!
As a series regular to kind of, I guess, fill the void of James Olsen.
You can't see what I'm doing right now, Nick, but just imagine that gif of Mike Tenay and Don West celebrating in the Impact Zone. That's what I just did right now. I just pumped my fist. We're losing James Olsen and gaining Wynn back. Mm-hmm. What a win.
Yeah, what a win indeed.
Very excited about that. All right. Now, let's move over to Sindhu Ramamurthy, who was best known for his role as Mohinder Suresh on Heroes.
What's that name again, Greg?
Mohinder Suresh.
No, the other name.
Sindhu Ramamurthy.
Okay.
Is that correct?
I don't know. I just wanted to hear you say it again.
And he will be appearing on The Flash as the main villain this season. He'll be playing the villain Bloodwork.
Strangely enough, another story I read but forgot to include. Apparently, Flash is going to have two main villains this season. They are doing a big bad pre-crisis and a big bad post-crisis. So almost two distinct story arcs for Flash this season. No indication yet whether he is the first half big bad or the second half big bad. You would certainly think more likely the first half big bad based on the fact that they're getting probably shooting already and he's been cast.
Yes, and they did put out that teaser video already.
They put
out a teaser video of sort of the effect as the blood takes over his eyes, where it appears that his gimmick is going to be that he believes he's covered a way to prevent anyone from dying.
Mm.
And so his goal is going to be to do whatever he's doing is going to be for the benefit of mankind, that it will prevent death from happening. So, kind of a concept. And it cannot be worse than last season's villain, right?
No, it cannot. There's no way it's worse than Cicada. At the very least, we know for a fact that Matt Ramamurthy can act, whereas Chris Klein, we are still unsure as to that.
No, I think we're pretty sure.
I mean, he keeps getting work somehow. So, I mean, like, somebody out there must believe that he can, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
Oh. And then finally in DC television news, exciting announcements for Bat fans that the series Batwoman is going to reveal the origin story of the major Batman villain, Tommy Elliott, a.k.a. Hush.
Yes.
I just scrolled way too fast. News drama and its pop-up videos. Gotta love them, right? Over the course of the first season, we will see Tommy Elliott become the supervillain Hush. Now, that's exciting news, but it seems as if they're going to tie Tommy perhaps into Kate, rather than into Bruce, which, you know, whatever. As long as I get Hush, I'm happy.
Yeah, I mean, you want villains who are going to have a connection to Kate. Batwoman is not a character who has an extensively deep rogues gallery. So, makes sense that you're probably going to take... I mean, let's be fair here, Greg. As much as you and I love Hush, in the eyes of the general public, he's probably a second-tier, at best, Batman villain. So he's probably one that most people are going to be more accepting of repurposing to have that tie to Kate rather than to Bruce.
Yeah, and it can't, again, it can't be any worse than the version they did on Gotham. So.
I didn't actually read the Newsarama story. Did they specifically say Tommy Elliott?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was wondering if it wouldn't be possible for a female Hush, perhaps, but if they said Tommy, then they said Tommy.
Well, I didn't read the article in detail, but it seemed like I did see the name Tommy Elliott multiple times in it. So, and I'm not opening it again. So, people at home, again, let us know. Tweet us at JRsBBQ. Mm-hmm. Let us know what your thoughts are on Hush coming to Batwoman. But that's all from DC and the world of television, Nick. There was more. Because over on the DC Universe streaming app, which is separate, of course, from the CW-verse, the Arrowverse, if you will,
mm-hmm.
we got the unveiling of the first trailer for the upcoming Harley Quinn animated series, the R-rated, mature-rated, I should say, Harley Quinn animated series. I had a chance to watch this today, Nick. Did you?
Yeah, I watched it, I think the day it came out. Maybe the day after. I've watched it, though.
I thought it was really, really good.
It is.
Was not sold on this project until I saw the video, really. Well, I think about the teaser video was good, too. But now seeing what the actual animation is going to look like, the general approach, this looks pretty great to me.
Yeah, it does. It looks perfect for a Harley Quinn standalone series. I mean, it could do a more dramatic Harley Quinn series, and it could be good if you wanted to focus on, like, you know, her vicious cycle of with the Joker and all that kind of stuff. But for the Harley that is more popular in the modern times, that has sold millions, literally millions of comics at this point, this is kind of what people want to see. This over-the-top adventures, and looks like some great meta references are going to be thrown in there. This looks fun.
We also got the formal announcements that Doom Patrol has been renewed for season 2, which has got a lot of people fired up, and Young Justice has been renewed for season 4 and is already in production for season 4, Nick.
Makes sense, because animation typically takes a lot longer to produce. I remember, you know, they announced Young Justice was returning, and then it was like, it felt like it was like 2 years before they were ready to premiere, because it just takes long to draw this stuff. So, exciting on both fronts. And notably, Doom Patrol season 2, in addition to coming back to DC Universe, is also going to be used as a selling point for HBO Max, the larger Warner Brothers streaming service. So already Warner Brothers, seeing the value in some DC property, is going to allow it to stream in multiple locations.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. I think, you know, that anybody that wants to be exposed to this show, and it's a really fun show, I'd recommend giving it a shot and seeing what you can get out of it. So, yet another DC property, or at least owned by DC and Warner Brothers. HBO premiered this past week the first official full trailer for the upcoming Damon Lindelof-helmed Watchmen series. You can go and watch this on YouTube and judge for yourself.
I had a coworker come by today to ask me about Comic-Con stuff. And he was like, did you see the Watchmen trailer? And I was like, I did. And he was like, wasn't it great? And I was like, yeah. And that's all I said.
Well, tell us, Nick. Tell us how great it was.
Not very, in my estimation. And I can't even really put my finger on what it is I didn't like about it. But it was 3.5 minutes of... I don't know why I didn't like it. I really, because like the production values are high, the cast looks good, some of the costume designs are interesting. It's just every bit of dialogue, and I understand it's a trailer, so you have to sell the premise of the show in brief, right?
Yeah.
But every bit of dialogue seems so heavy-handed with metaphor none of it felt natural, and that is going to be a problem. If that's the way the entire show reads, you know?
I have been very open to Watchmen concepts, even ones that diverge from the source material. I consider the book to be the best comic book ever written. I love the Zack Snyder movie from 2009. I really like the comic. I really liked... I like the video game they did out of the movie. Even before Watchmen, some of those didn't work for me, but some of them did. I haven't read all of them by any means. And of course, I love Doomsday Clock. This is the first Watchmen-related property where I watched the trailer and I felt how some of our friends felt when they watched the movie. Where I watched this trailer and I was like, this is not Watchmen. This is some political, modern political allegory, granted, but it's like dressed up as Watchmen characters. Right. Like it was not, at no point in this trailer did I get the feeling that this even feels like the original story in terms of its, what it's going for and what it's trying to, the scene where the woman talks to her daughter
yes.
in this trailer is
so forced.
Awful. Like, terribly awful. No, honey, we know the world isn't in color. We know the world is black and white. Oh my gosh, come on. If that now granted, trailers have been misleading before.
Absolutely.
So maybe the show will be better than the trailer. We're all going to give it a shot. Let's be honest. We're not going to skip this show. But this trailer, I actually at one time had high hopes for this show. And everything that gets released about it gives me less and less hope for it. And I just,
which is crazy considering the cast. Again, I keep going back to that. Like, you know, having Dotson and Jeremy Irons involved and Regina King. Like, these are good actors. This should be an exciting cast. And the cast is exciting. It's just the approach seems to be I can't put it into words what exactly my apprehension is.
Our friend Tim Capel, I think, put it best in our chat, where to paraphrase him here, where he said essentially that it's like someone read Watchmen and they were like, do you know what would be a great groundbreaking idea? What if, like, we took a real life approach to superheroes? And it's like, what if we examined and deconstructed the hero? And it's already been done in Watchmen. And none of the ideas presented in this trailer are new or fresh or different in any way. Maybe in the show they will be. I don't know. But it didn't do anything for me, man.
No, I agree.
And we got another announcement that didn't do much for me. Nick, coming up next, which is the announcement I know that is special for you in particular. That is the Walking Dead movies from AMC that have long been talked about, featuring Andrew Lincoln's Rick Grimes.
Yes, these were supposed to be originally a trilogy of direct-to-TV Rick Grimes films.
Instead, they're going to theaters, everybody. Now, Comic-Con, and then subsequently on Twitter, they will be released by Universal Pictures. No release dates were announced. They will follow the character of Rick Grimes in his journeys after the incident that led to his departure from the series. I have a plan, Nick.
What's your plan, Greg?
My plan is never to watch these movies in the theater.
You know what the thing about this is?
That I'm probably going to watch them in the theater.
That you're probably going to watch them in the theater, and that we're going to get bombarded with a Rick Grimes theatrical movie release advertising campaign. Because the way you advertise a direct-to-TV movie and the way you advertise a theatrical movie are so completely different. I am not ready for the onslaught of 30-second Rick Grimes ad spots on Monday Night Raw every week. I'm just not. Like, I don't want it.
Don't forget, by the way, welcome back to Monday Night Raw. Don't forget this weekend to check out The Walking Dead, The Return of Rick. And here's a clip from it, Corey.
God almighty. My interest in this has been non-existent the entire time, essentially, but this makes it... No. Absolutely not. No.
No. The show got infinitely better once Rick Grimes was taken off the board. And that's no knock on Andrew Lincoln, who I think Andrew Lincoln is wonderful, and I wish him all the success in the world. But the show got better when his character was taken off the board because of the way the character has been written over the years. So, I'm not particularly interested in any of these, but... who knows? Maybe they'll be great. We'll discuss more during Walking Dead month in a few months. All right. So we also had a ton of announcements regarding these collections of paper and staples that are known as comic books.
Hmm.
Apparently, individuals buy these and read them.
Hmm.
And we've got a litany of announcements, the majority of which that we have on our list came from Marvel, but we also had plenty from other companies, but we're going to let our buddies Russell and Todd handle the majority of the DC announcements from Comic-Con. We are going to focus primarily on Marvel in this section, but Nick, this was just a bevy of announcements. We'll save the biggest announcements for last, and I'll start with some that are kind of under the radar a little bit. First of all, we've got one of the more unusual announcements. Which is,
it's not that unusual, actually. And you go ahead, but I'll explain it. Go. You tell them.
Mary Jane Watson is getting her own series, Amazing Mary Jane, by Leah Williams and Carlos Gomez. This is going to follow Mary Jane, tries to make it in Hollywood without realizing that she's being manipulated by Mysterio and another even more dangerous individual.
This is not strange at all, because the big two are notorious for ripping one another constantly. And what's one of DC's hottest comics right now? Lois Lane.
Lois Lane.
You had to know something like this was coming.
Yeah, and I guess there's two lines of thinking here. Number one, that the Lois Lane angle that you pointed out, although I would point out that Lois has always been a better character than Mary Jane for the entirety of, of her existence.
In your opinion, I would likely agree as well, but I'm saying there are people out there who will read a Mary Jane ongoing.
Well, that brings me to point number two. Who's the character, the female character at Marvel that has kind of been getting a lot of buzz in the last couple years? It's a Spider-Man supporting character, Gwen Stacy. Mm-hmm. Spider-Gwen has been wildly successful and has created a whole generation of Gwen Stacy fans. So maybe their thing is, we need to give Mary Jane something to do, or she's going to end up lost in the wayside, replaced for all intents and purposes by Gwen Stacy. So maybe it's a chance to sort of get Mary Jane a little bit of cultural cash going that she kind of hasn't had in a long time, and really since the events of One More Day.
Absolutely.
We also got an announcement of a Doctor Doom book by Christopher Cantwell and Salvador Larroca. I don't really care, Nick, but what are your thoughts on Doctor Doom and this book?
None.
Fair enough. Well, let's get on to the meat of the matter, shall we?
Actually, why don't we do the do all the X-Men stuff last. Why don't we talk about Strange Adventures real quick?
Okay, well, DC made an announcement of a new Tom King and Mitch Gerrits ongoing.
Now, you and I have not read any of their work that they've done together outside of Batman, you know, some of the Batman stuff.
That's correct. That's correct.
So we're not
Mr. Miracle, though.
Yeah, familiar with their Mr. Miracle work, or do they do Vision together as well?
I don't know.
But anyway, we haven't read any of the stuff, so we are probably not overly qualified to talk about our level of excitement for Strange Adventures, but nonetheless, go ahead.
Yes, Strange Adventures is indeed the name of the book, and it is going to be featuring Adam Strange, and the article from Newsarama indicates that it will be Adam Strange dealing with ramifications from Rand Thanagar War, which is something that happened, I don't know if they read it in Rebirth, or if it is referring to the Rand Thanagar War from Infinite Crisis. But regardless, it's all about Adam Strange. There's also, curiously, in that article from Newsarama, a clip that shows Wally West. So I wonder if there will be backup stories in there featuring Wally following in the events of Heroes in Crisis. So that's coming up, I believe, later this year, Nick.
Awesome.
Well, yes, the big line of X-Men titles was unveiled that will follow the two mini-series from Jonathan Hickman that we have talked about on the show in recent weeks. These will be relaunches across the line of X-Men. New teams, new lineups, yada yada, sort of purporting to be a fresh start for the X-Men universe. So let's just... That was a weird noise outside, but we're going to ignore that for now. Let's just go with the big ones up front. Jonathan Hickman and Lenil Francis Yu are going to be writing the ongoing, simply titled X-Men. And this is going to consist of the lineup of a bunch of Summerses. Cyclops, Jean Grey, Corsair, who of course is Cyclops' pappy. Lincoln, the lost Summers brother. Havoc, Alex Summers. Rachel Summers. And, for some reason, Wolverine. Interesting lineup here. Nick, what do you look?
God, this sounds like Tim Capel's dream lineup. Does it not? Mm-hmm. Just Summers everywhere.
Summerses. And yeah, it does sound like an interesting book. I'm curious why Wolverine is there. But
no Storm, no, not like, all right, I guess.
We'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. The other big book the other Jonathan Hickman book, I should say, not the big book, but the other Jonathan Hickman book is going to be written by Hickman and Ed Brisson and drawn by Rod Reese, and it will be a new volume of New Mutants. And this lineup consists of Sunspot, Wolfsbane, Mirage, Karma, Magic, Cypher, Chamber, and Mondo. I only know about half of this group of characters, so this is probably the one that maybe appeals the least to me, but could be good. New Mutants has a long and storied history of being really cool. So your thoughts on this one, Nick?
None.
Fair enough. Moving on, we have Marauders by Jerry Duggan and Matteo Lolli, and it consists of the lineup of Captain Kate Pride, Emma Frost.
What is a Captain Kate Pride?
Couldn't tell you. Emma Frost, Storm, Pyro, Bishop, and Iceman. A very sort of 80s-friendly lineup here to the Marauders.
I'm trying to look this up, what a Kate Pride is.
It's Kitty Pride, but now she goes by Kate.
Oh. Why?
I guess she got old and didn't want to be called Kitty anymore. I don't know. Beats me. I haven't read X-Men in 20 years, man. I'm behind the eight ball on this stuff.
That is a dick to Rick like change that just isn't necessary. In my view.
We also have Excalibur by Tinny Howard and Marcus Toe. And it consists of, now this is where I'm going to need some help, Nick. This consists of Captain Britain,
mm-hmm.
which I'm going to put a star next to that one for now, okay?
Okay.
Captain Britain, Rogue, Gambit, Jubilee, who's going to have to be out of, Richter, and Apocalypse? Question mark? The Apocalypse thing I read about, though, Nick, I read a description of this, and it sounds like it's going to be an alternate Apocalypse, like an alternate universe Apocalypse, perhaps. I don't think this is going to be En Sabineur that we're all familiar with. And there seems to be an indication that they may not be able to fully trust him even still. The question that I have is, I did not know, maybe this happened a long time ago, I didn't know that Brennan and Betsy Braddock had split off again from the Psylocke persona. So, you know, Betsy Braddock was Psylocke, but they were, through convoluted comic book means, was merged with the ninja assassin Quinnen. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but that's how it read in the comics. And, you know, and Betsy was Psylocke, right? Well, here, Betsy is not Psylocke anymore. She is now Captain Britain, assuming the role of her brother, Brian Braddock. Makes enough sense. Except Quinnen is still running around as Psylocke, but known as Quinnen. So, what I'm asking, Nick, and you're the wrong person to ask this to. I should have asked this in our group chat.
I didn't follow one word you just said.
You know what? Let's just move on.
Yeah, let's do that.
To Fallen Angels by Brian Edward
Jeremy Dillon. Reynolds here to explain why it isn't that complicated, because Jesus Christ.
Well, Brian Edward Hill, who is a writer on the rise right now, and Szymon Kudrzanski is the artist on this one.
Oh, here you go.
And they will be doing a team that includes Psylocke, which is Quinnen, as mentioned a minute ago, Cable, and who I thought was dead, and X-23.
Time travel, Greg. Cable's never dead.
So this actually sounds awesome to me. The premise of they're all out for revenge, and their revenge mission could put in danger every other plan by the other X-teams, but that sounds awesome to me. This actually sounds like something I would have come up with for a pitch in our comic book drafts. Mm-hmm. So, interesting team here. X-23, Cable, Psylocke. I like it. What about you?
Yeah. I am out of my element with this X stuff.
You gave me a jumping Jeff Farmer-like reaction. Yep.
Yep. I mean, what else am I going to say? I'm not going to read it.
I'm down on you so hard. Jumping Jeff Farmer, Google it, folks.
And he would have fit well in Southpaw Regional Wrestling.
He would have. Why did not reach out to him and try to have it? They could have done one of those Tom McGee specials on him.
Kind of charismatic champion, John Johnson.
John Johnson. Oh, sadly, if they ever bring it back, he's no longer.
Nope.
No longer around. All right. X-Force, familiar title to all of X-Men fans out there in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
X-Force will be brought back by writer Benjamin Percy of Green Arrow fame, and artist Joshua Cassara. And sure. This will include... Oh, go ahead.
No, I just said sure.
And this will include a pretty massive lineup. Only six are officially listed in the description, but if you look at the cover, there are two extra characters. So, listed in the description of this book, X-Force, are Beast, Jean Grey, Sage, Wolverine, Kid Omega, and Domino. Mm-hmm. However, the cover also includes Colossus and Black Tom Cassidy, which is the one that I'm interested to see how they work that one in. Thoughts on this one, Nick?
Yeah.
This is actually the books. This is the one that I'm most interested in. I love this lineup.
Yeah, if I were going to read one, this would probably be the one, because, you know, I like Ben Percy, and I like that lineup pretty well. I don't know what a Sage is. I don't know what a Kid Omega is.
I don't either.
I'm not overly familiar with what a Black Tom Cassidy is, but other than a racist from Deadpool 2, yeah. That's all I know.
Yeah. Black Tom Cassidy controls trees, I think, and is the Juggernaut's friend. So that's interesting. Between that and the Apocalypse thing, what's been doing this for years? It goes back to, I remember there was an X-Men lineup that had Juggernaut on it. There was an X-Men lineup that had Sabretooth on it.
Dude, there's a Justice League book that has Darkseid in it right now.
Darkseid in it, exactly. Darkseid in it, Justice League with Lex Luthor. This seems to be the new norm with regards to relaunching team books, is including books that have prominent villains joining the heroes. So, I don't know. We'll see if they can pull it off or if it's just a gimmick. I don't know. We'll see. I think that one sounds interesting, though. And so that's the end of all of our X books. Nick, I know you were enthralled by that X-Men discussion. I feel so lost in these characters, and yet, the excitement from everyone else that is a long-time, long-suffering X-fan is palpable. And I admit I don't understand it, because I've never been the biggest Jonathan Hickman fan, but everybody's excited about this. So.
Well, I think the excitement level comes from Jonathan Hickman is probably, in an era where it feels like Marvel is losing more and more of its top-level talent over to DC. Outside of Mark Waid, who else is in the Marvel bullpen exclusively that you could put on the X-Men titles that would elicit this kind of response? Because
they would feel like a big deal.
It feels not just like a big deal to fans, but it feels like, for the first time in a long time, the X-Men are a big deal to Marvel corporate again, which I think has been one of the contentions people have had for some time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And hopefully this will end up being awesome. I can admit that I'm a little overwhelmed by it, because I'm not going to buy the weekly or the monthly comics.
The two miniseries that are leading into it, I believe, are alternating weeks weekly. I think it's going every week for 12 weeks.
So I feel a little overwhelmed only because my experience with Hickman has been that, through his Avengers, that if you don't read from the very beginning, that you're toast, essentially.
Yeah, I mean,
and if you don't read everything, so
you say that, but again, Secret Wars was his big climactic story that was supposed to wrap up everything he'd ever done. You know, his Fantastic Four run and his Avengers run all in one. And I read it without any context and enjoyed it and liked it and thought it was really good. So I'm sure there's other stuff I would have caught. I feel like I needed to read that other stuff to fully appreciate the story.
And I'm simply going off of his Avengers run, because I tried to pick it up at what was purported to be a jumping on point, setting up a new story. I can't remember what the story was. I don't remember the name of the big event that was coming up.
I think it was Secret Wars.
I don't know. I remember the issue. I remember the details of the issue, because it centered on Reed Richards' kids. Franklin and what's the girl's name? Valeria. And I was completely lost. I didn't know who all these characters were. I didn't know what they were talking about. It didn't make me interested to learn more. It just made me want to move on. But that's maybe me. I know people love Hey Man. A lot of people are reading these comics, so I'm excited for everybody else to be excited for it. Genuinely, I hope the X-Men can regain its spot, its deserved spot, as the most popular Marvel comic book out there. Because I do firmly believe that X-Men is the best of Marvel, and so I want to see them being given the attention that they deserve, that they haven't had in a long, long time. So good stuff here from Marvel. And finally, unfortunately, we have to wrap up with some sad news that is sort of ancillary to the comic book world, but passing of actor Rutger Hauer, who carved out a legendary career for himself in Hollywood, best known, of course, for Blade Runner, but also did have significant roles in the comic book world, most notably in the Christopher Nolan Batman Begins movie. He played Mr. Earl, who is sort of set up as the Obadiah Stane figure, if you will, in Batman Begins, where he has, he kind of takes over the company after Bruce leaves Gotham and ends up conspiring against Bruce later on, and so and trying to sort of undermine him when he comes back to regain control of his family business. So, that's probably his most popular role. He also had a role in Sin City. And, he played Cardinal Rourke in that one. Very memorable role in that movie. I thought he was great in Sin City. So, sad pick of a figure that's made an impact more so in movies in general, but also a little bit in the comic book realm as well.
Yeah, I just threw this on there because, Batman Begins, one of my favorite all-time movies, and see one of the major players from that film go. Lots of stuff he's done. I'll probably try to get around to watching Batman Begins and Blade Runner here in the next couple of weeks in his honor. So, good stuff.
Yes. And with that being said, folks, we are going to take a break. Again, we encourage you to reach out to us on Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87, sorry. And join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and let us know your thoughts on the rundown. When we come back from the break, we're going to have our exclusive Long Book Hunters review of one of the most famous Spider-Man stories of all time. It's J.M. DeMatteis. It's Mike Zeck. It is Kraven's Last Hunt.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and HistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back to the Hard Traveling Studios as we prepare to wrap up Spider Month. Mm. What a month it's been, Nick, right?
Yes, it's been, we've had our ups, our downs, and our lefts, and our, and here we are back at center.
Indeed. It's been an amazing, spectacular, and web of
kind you of always month. Leave out Friendly Neighborhood. Why is that?
Well, I also left out Peter Parker.
That's true. And Ultimate.
Ah, yes, Ultimate. I did leave out Ultimate. And 2099.
And Ultimate Comics.
I don't know if there's any other ones. There probably are. But
Noir. Noir.
Yes. Blue.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it has been it is a crowded and busy time here at Place to Be Nation, Nick. And let's take a look, if you will, at what's going on around the Place to Be Nation pop feed. First of all, the Sarcastic Four, of which you are one,
mm-hmm.
continues its look at the 1971 year.
And by the time this episode is out, Greg, we will have our third part of 1971 out.
Ah, continues its look at 1971 with the third of their three-part episode looking at the year 1971 on the Middle Age podcast. Give us a little sneak peek of what we might expect if we listen to that episode.
Rutland Halloween is without a doubt the worst town I've ever read about.
On the 9th episode of Laugh in Theater, Andy is joined by J. Arsenio D'Amato to do a live watch of the 2005 comedy, The 40-Year-Old Virgin. On the first episode of Songs with Friends, Steve and Kelly talk Gin Blossoms and DMX. I think we need to hit up Steve and Kelly, Nick, to do some Sammy Kershaw tunes. What do you think?
Absolutely.
The Hard Traveling Fanboys are us. We don't need to shill our month for you. You're already listening. Our last episode was indeed about the Sam Raimi Spider-Man film. I would recommend it.
Not to get off topic, Greg, but let me pose a question to you.
Sure.
What would you sooner pay money to eat? A taco from Burger King or a pulled pork sandwich from Burger King?
Oh, pulled pork.
No, taco.
You're nuts. Have you seen the taco from Burger King?
No person wants to go to Burger King for barbecue. That's blasphemous.
But yet you'll go to McDonald's and eat a McRib.
That's different. It's its own thing.
Why? How is the McRib different?
The McRib is not even trying to pass itself off as a classic barbecue staple the way that pulled pork is.
Yeah, but here's the other thing. Have you looked at the Burger King tacos? They don't look like food.
One, they're cheaper. Two, tacos suck anyway, so I'll just eat the stupid taco.
Tacos suck. Okay, you have set the new standard for all-time bad takes on Hard Traveling Fanboys. No. Tacos suck?
Mexican food in general is overrated.
Well, I'd expect that from someone like you.
What's that mean?
I'm just saying. I can see it right here. I can see it written all over your face. Mexican food's not good. The next thing you're going to say is that Asian food's not good.
It's not my favorite.
It's got to be a good old-fashioned pancake.
No. Italian food, though. That's where the that's where the power lies.
I do like Italian food. I can't lie. Honestly, Nick, the problem that I've run into, you may have encountered something similar, probably not. The problem I've run into is I've realized that I like almost all kinds of food. Which is not good.
I like most kinds of food. I mean, like, even Mexican food, I say it's overrated, but I will eat it from time to time. I'm generally not a big Asian food eater.
I like Americanized Asian food. Like, today I went to Panda Express.
Oh, yeah.
And enjoyed a delicious fried rice, which I'm sure was very healthy for me. Very good stuff, you know. Like, I find also, Nick, that the problem is most of the food that I'm attracted to eating is actually food that is bad for me to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, so, of course. That's a pork sandwich.
Yeah, exactly.
From anyway, where were we?
All right. DC4U continues its celebration of Superman with a look back at the pilot episode of the classic TV series Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, and they pay tribute to the late Eddie Jones, who played Pa Kent, passed away recently. Pop Goes the Movies, when Andy and Miranda discuss Toy Story 4 and Men in Black International. Kind of a tale of there in some ways. Glenn and Alana are back, actually, in all ways, that's a tale of two movies. It's literally a tale of two movies. Anyway, that was a stupid line from me. Glenn and Alana are back with a new spectacular review of Things Season 3. And the Great Debate number 6 finds host Andy joined by Jordan Duncan, Scott Criscolo, and some scallywag known as Nick Duke to discuss a variety of topics. Give us a little snippet of that one, Nick. What can we expect if we listen to that one?
You have given me this time to talk about hockey, and in the great Georgia tradition, I will give it right back to you.
Very good. I want to remind everyone that the greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. There will be 6 polls a day posted for round 1, which is still ongoing. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament and liking the page. But it's not limited to Facebook. You can also go to Twitter, to the Place to Be Nation Twitter account, and vote there. In fact, I encourage everyone to vote early and vote often.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, over on the rest feed, Ben Zani dropped two episodes of Row One Seat One this week, welcoming in guests Dominic Greeny and Tony Deppen. On episode 130 of Main Event, Scott, Nate, and Steve are joined by Sheriff Pete Scherzer to talk New Japan G1 Climax, AEW Impact, Evolve, and much more. Chris and Devon Dudley are back to bring you a same-night review of Extreme Rules 2019. In the latest episode of the PTBN podcast, JT and Scott welcome Tim Slomka to the mothership as they talk the WWF Madison Square Garden house from October 1989. And don't miss the pilot episode of a new ECW-focused podcast entitled PTBN Extreme Three-Way Dance, where hosts Jeff Rosero, Jennifer Smith, and John D'Amato review the concept of the show and what is to come. And, of course, over on PlaceToBeNation.com, our tribute to 1994 is off and running with a brand new piece on Woodstock 94, as well as a piece where JT looks back at Bob Backlund challenging Bret Hart for the WWF title on Superstars. Also, excellent Network Adventure Team is back with a look at Black Saturday from 1984. And check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.press.com for information on joining our GWWE PPV and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Very good. So with all that said and done, let's move on to the Longbook Hunters. The title of this episode, the centerpiece of this episode, because we are here to wrap up Spider Month by reviewing a book that, believe it or not, neither Nick nor I have ever read before
this
occasion.
This is one of our biggest, especially for me as a big Spider-Man fan, one of, you know, our biggest blind spots. We've been ridiculed and mocked by the likes of Ben Morris for not having not read this series, and now we have finally gotten around to it.
Absolutely. It is Kraven's Last Hunt, a six-issue storyline from the mid-80s that took place across three different Spider-Man ongoings. Yes, Nick, there were three Spider-Man ongoings at the time. You had Amazing Spider-Man, Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, and Web of Spider-Man. And this is by writer J.M. DeMatteis, known for a variety, I mean, really a variety of things, but Justice America alongside Keith Giffen, long runs on Spider-Man, very, pretty much every character under the sun, DeMatteis has had a run on. By the way, this book, this story is from 1987, plays out in the pages of Spectacular Spider-Man 131 and 132. Amazing Spider-Man 293 and 294, and Web of Spider-Man 31 and 32. It has been collected numerous times over the years. We are Marvel Unlimited. This is one of the seminal works in Spider-Man's history. You still hear people today name Kraven's Last Hunt as the greatest Spider-Man story of them all. It's been voted that in numerous polls, certainly among the 5 or 10 stories that get mentioned and associated with the character of Spider-Man the most. And like you said, Nick, it was a big blind spot for both of us. We had never read it. We knew of its legacy, I think, and its sort of reverence that it was held in, but had never had a chance to read it. So the big question going in, I suppose, is this an occasion like a certain Avengers story that we read where it had gotten a lot of hype to us, and we read it, and we did not think that it lived up to the hype? Or the complete opposite of that. I will go ahead and say for myself, the complete opposite of that.
Yes, the complete opposite of that. This lived up to the hype. This met the expectations. This has earned its reputation, unlike other things we have read for Longbook Hunters in the past.
It was revelatory in many ways. This takes place during probably my favorite creative era of comics, in term across the board comics. Marvel, DC, both firing on all cylinders, creative this time. We have in the mid-80s, we go over this every time we review a book from this era, you have The Longbow Hunters from Mike Grell. You have Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One from Frank Miller. You have Watchmen coming shortly before this story comes out. You have Frank Miller's Daredevil coming around in the 80s. You have
Killing Joke.
Killing Joke. You have Claire
Grant Morrison's A Serious House on Serious Earth.
You have Claremont's X-Men is still in full force at this time. The comics are Squadron Supreme. You have comics are just in a creative renaissance of sorts in these in the mid 80s here. So this story from line there, and one of the interesting things that I noticed in picking this up and reading it from the get go, Nick, is there's some status quo things that kind of caught me off. Really only a couple, because I didn't realize that Peter Parker and Mary Jane had already gotten married at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But they are when this story starts. They're actually newlyweds. It mentions in the text that they had been married recently.
Yeah, very recently, it seems like, because they're still living. She hasn't even fully moved in yet. They've gotten married, mm-hmm. and like she has her own place still, a bare bones place because she's packing up. But still, you get the impression it's very, very recent.
And so Peter Parker is actually sporting the black suit that we would know today as Venom, the Venom look. He is wearing the
Secret Wars was what, 85?
Is that 84, I think.
Okay, but after he came back, Secret Wars, he wore that suit even after he lost got the symbiote removed from him. He still used that suit as a fabric suit, just as an aesthetic update for the character for several years to come.
And this was one that was given to him by Felicia Hardy, and it's one that he has worn for several years at this point, and will continue to wear for a while until the unveiling of, actually pretty not too long after this, the unveiling of Venom. That's when the suit changes back full-time to the iconic red and blue duds. So those are kind of the status quo things that shook me. Also, Robbie Robertson, who's a classic Spider-Man character, is going by his real first name of Joe here, as Joe Robertson. And is the, I believe, listed as the editor of the Daily Bugle at this time. I don't know what the status of J. Jonah Jameson was at this point. Yeah, granted, we could have researched all this, but we really wanted to approach, A, we didn't care to, and B, we really wanted to approach this from the concept of somebody picking up this book and reading it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does it hold up? How does it make sense to us, having not been exposed to the continuity around it? And I'm happy to report that with these little minor things that were like, oh, that's different, it holds up real well, and it wasn't difficult to follow at all because it tells a standalone story.
It really does. The only thing that I think would probably be additive or informative is if you had a decent knowledge of Spider-Man with Kraven, that would probably help you to understand things in some ways, or at least set the context a little better. But even in Marvel Age, we've not read many Kraven stories, and the only ones that we have, frankly, sucked. So
mm-hmm.
I can't say that having a pre-existing knowledge of Kraven, based on what I've read anyway, has done that much. It really is so unlike any version of Kraven I've ever read before this that it completely redefines the character in my eyes.
Very much so. Very much so. And would subsequently define future versions of the character, future takes on the character. It is. I sort of agree, but I also disagree in that they kind of give you everything you need to know about Kraven through his inner monologue, about his origin, about his parents being exiles from Russia, and how his mother is insane, and his father is a loser, basically, and all of this trauma that he goes through as a child, and how that probably shapes him into what he becomes later, defined by his a family's idea of what honor is and what dignity is, and the indoctrination that he gets into the filth of America and things of that nature, and the filth of his homeland of Russia now once it's been taken over. And so you get a lot of this with him. But I would say actually the one thing that I might could have used, even though they explain it in dialogue, is I think it would have been neat to include in a collected edition of this, and maybe they do, I don't know, the first appearance of Vermin, who plays a big factor in here. It would be interesting to see how he comes to be and how he first encounters Spider-Man and Captain America. Vermin is a character that was actually created by DeMatteis and Zek, and they bring that character back as a focal point character in Kraven's Last Hunt, almost a third lead character here. He even gets his own inner monologue. Mm-hmm. The characters that get inner monologues here are Kraven, Spider-Man, Mary Jane, and mm-hmm. so that's one thing that I could say would have been helpful.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree, because I remember I asked you on the phone. I was like, I'm not familiar with this Vermin character, because he's not one that's really been used very much in the modern context since then.
Mm-hmm.
So, having not read a lot of Marvel in general, it was a bit jarring to me. But he did a decent enough job of justifying mm-hmm. his role in the story. He's kind of this third, it's kind of this impartial physical threat who is caught in between what is essentially a dick measuring contest between Kraven and Spider-Man.
Right.
Like, it's not a dick measuring contest that Spider-Man's interested in being in, but it's one he's been forced into nonetheless.
And Vermin is also a tragic character, a character who kills because he must, because he appealed to rather than because he wants to. And it also, in my opinion, Nick, I don't know if you'd agree with this, the way that Spider-Man deals with Vermin, in contrast to the way that Kraven deals with Vermin, is one of those great character defining moments. It establishes what makes Spider-Man different
mm-hmm.
from Kraven, and then also, on a metatextual level, what makes Spider-Man different from some of the other characters that were really popular at this time. Daredevil, Batman.
Yeah.
That's
the most notable, I think, comparison is because, like I told you this, after reading the first two issues, this reads more like a Batman story than any Spider-Man story I've ever read. And that's not a bad thing. It's a compliment. It's just I've never read a Spider-Man story that's dark and gritty before. And this is very unusual for me anyway. But like you said, it's very inspired by the era in which it is being produced. It reads very much like a 1980s Batman story, which is remarkable. Yes.
Yeah, and one of the things that I thought as I was reading it is this is a totally new territory for you because you grew up with a different Spider-Man. You grew up with the Ultimate Spider-Man. This is the Spider-Man that I actually grew up with. Was this kind of the J.M. DeMatteis the take on Spider-Man that is an adult that is dealing with really grimy issues, really like. He's not dealing with the problems that a teenager deals with. He's dealing with the problem that a 20-something deals with. And it gets heavy. And I remember stories dealing with the death of parents and suicide and drug addiction and things like that. But the beauty of this, I thought, is I think it would be very easy in writing this story to just write it as a Batman story. Right?
Right.
Because I thought the same thing the first two issues in. I was like, man, this reads like a great Batman story. But the key thing here is that DeMatteis does not lose sight of Peter Parker.
Right.
Doesn't lose sight of the fact that he's not Batman. He's not Daredevil. Ooh. And multiple times in this story, when he is given a chance to embrace the darkness, if you will, to embrace the, mm-hmm. the madness inside him, to embrace the anger and the venom, so to speak, that we'll run in the Spider-Man series, when he's given a chance to do all these things, to be violent, to be to go after revenge, he always pulls himself back because that's not who he is. That is not who Parker is. He's not the avenging angel. He's not the Dark Knight who's going to come down and pummel these guys to a bloody pulp. That's not what he's all about. He's all about trying to find another solution and yet, I also thought this, Nick, he's also not like Superman or Captain America,
no.
where he's always going to do the right thing.
No,
we have actual moments where he feels fear and even cowardice a couple times in this story.
And moments where he lets go with his rage a little bit, where mm-hmm. he doesn't show restraint at all. He is imperfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's ultimately the point of the story is that he's trying to make, is that the story on a psychological level is that Kraven has built Spider-Man up as this ideal being, because he's been beaten by him so many times, and he's so assured of his own superiority that he thinks that only the perfect being can beat him. And Peter Parker's secret is that no, I'm all along. I'm just imperfect Peter Parker. I'm just a man, and we get to see that throughout here as he makes mistakes. He lashes out at Vermin in particular, and yet never really loses the core, like you said, of what makes him a hero. So outstanding work from a character standpoint with Spider-Man here from DeMatteis.
Yeah, and another there's a really good sequence in here. One of the moments in Kraven's last hunt involves, and it happens very early on, so I feel like this isn't too much of a spoiler for a 40-year-old story to say this, but there's a 30-year-old, but there's a moment in this story where you get a sequence where Peter gets buried alive, literally gets tranquilized and put in a coffin and buried and has to dig his way out. Well, there's a sequence where we see what he's going through when he's doing that, and the psychological battle that he's fighting to dig himself out. And it involves embracing the spider that we see Kraven refer to him as, the spider. And what we see is eventually Peter, the man, defeats the spider and crawls out of that, because that's who he is at his core.
Right.
And it struck me as another great mirror image of a great Batman story. Because how many Batman stories have we seen this sequence play out where the bat wins, where it's the bat emerges and that's who he is? Not so here. I thought that was a great sequence in the story, and that he's Peter Parker. He loves Mary Jane. That's who he is. That's who he wants to be. He's not this mystical entity, as you were mentioning a moment ago. He is not the spider. That's just that he puts on to fight criminals, you know. Really good stuff. But they, you know, just as much of a Spider-Man story, maybe even more so than a Spider-Man story, it's certainly as much. This is a Kraven story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a Kraven who, let's just be honest, is insane.
Yes, has lost. Yeah, he's lost it, no doubt. But, I mean, I think he hasn't lost it completely quite yet, because he's got those moments of clarity. It's not like a stark raving lunatic. It's not like a Joker situation. He's insane, but he still has those moments of clarity that make you that help to actually really ground him and help you kind of experience the descent into madness that he is, as he spirals further and further out of control throughout the story.
Yeah, and you put it very well a moment ago that this is really about his ego. I mean, his ego can't handle the fact that he's been beaten by a mere man all these times. He believes that as a result of all these chemicals that he's been ingesting over a long period of time, many decades, or at least a decade at this point, he's been consuming these chemicals and roots and herbs, that, as he calls them, that have been altering his mind, clearly. And in his weakened mental state, he views in Spider-Man this mystical creature, the spider, that he imbues every negative thing ever experienced in his life. So he blames the spider for people claiming that his mother was crazy, even though he calls her an angel multiple times in this story. He blames the spider for his father's weakness. He blames the spider for destroying the soul of Mother Russia. He blames the spider for America's filth and corruption. He blames the spider for not allowing him to ever have happiness or peace, which he claims multiple times he's really after. He has to regain his honor, first of all, by defeating the spider. Not just capturing the spider or killing the spider, but proving that he's better than the spider, that he is its superior in any way. You might say, Nick, that he is the superior Spider-Man.
Yeah, he definitely, that word superior is thrown around so much, I wonder if this wasn't a direct influence on Dan Slott whenever he got ready to do that run later.
Yeah, I would suspect probably so. And he, you know, Kraven is obsessed with this. And yet the whole time, one of the interesting remarks in this that I thought was just really cool, and I don't know if I've seen anything like it, I probably have in some Batman stories that I'm not remembering at the moment, but the idea of a dueling inner monologue within these characters, you get it with Peter, MJ, and Kraven, but Kraven perhaps more so than the rest, because Kraven seems to have a voice of rationality and a voice of utter madness. And in the beginning of this story, that voice of madness is over. And is able to almost shout down the rationality of Kraven. He can't decide, he can't figure out if he's Sergei Kravenov, or if he's Kraven the Hunter, or if he's the spider. So it's this crazy internal conflict of madness. And you compound that, or you contrast that rather, with the inner monologues of Peter and MJ, where there's this parenthetical sort of narration box that kind of expresses their doubts and their fears. right? That are like, you know, kind of countering whatever their positive thoughts are. There's this little voice that's telling them, but Peter's dead, or telling Peter, but you can't escape. You know, things like that. I thought that was such an interesting writing take. What did you make of that?
Loved it. I've never seen anything like it, really. And like you said, it fits in because of that dichotomy that there is between, with Craven, between the sanity and the insanity, and with Peter, between Peter at his best and Peter at his worst. Peter at his most confident and Peter at his most fearful. This internal struggle he's going through. So all the characters here are really going through these internal battles, and so that dual monologue just makes a whole lot of sense. It's a great storytelling technique that I've never seen before, but yet expertly used here.
Absolutely. And Craven, as part of his mission, we mentioned, buries Spider-Man alive. And while Spider-Man is buried alive, Craven assumes his identity as Spider-Man to prove that he's better, to prove that he's superior. And he goes around, and his way of proving he's superior is he kills criminals. He goes around, he's breaking necks, he's, you know, beating people just to death, literally to death. And then he picks a fight with Vermin, who has been going around killing women at night that are kind of vulnerable. He drags them down in the sewers and literally eats them. And the newspapers are labeling him the cannibal killer. So Craven takes upon himself to beat Vermin because Spider-Man needed help from Captain America to beat him last time. So Craven figures, well, if I can beat him on my own, that means I'm definitely better than Spider-Man. So he does that. He beats Vermin by himself and traps him. And sure enough, once Peter does escape his hellish, you know, situation of being buried alive, one of the other things that I loved about this story, Nick, that you don't see in superhero comics, generally speaking, Peter doesn't just come out of the grave and he's pissed off and fired up and he's ready to go kick some ass. He is, don't get me wrong. He's pissed off and he's ready to go kick some ass, but he's also tired. He's fatigued. And in his heart of hearts, all he can keep thinking is how terrified he is. This experience has utterly changed him irrevocably. He comes out of that coffin and he keeps flashing back to it constantly, to being in that coffin, to not being able to breathe, to having to drag himself out of the dirt, to the agony of being buried alive, to a fear of death, which is another you don't see often in superhero comics, is the lead character actually being afraid for his own safety, which is a natural human reaction. I love that part, Nick.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, we get, of course, the conflict between them. He comes in, as you mentioned, as a sort of figure in the middle of all this. He is committing these crimes. He is ultimately, in his own way, a victim who also is making victims of others. And we get inner monologues of him where he oscillates between being animalistic and almost fearful, like a fearful child at times. And it's an interesting dichotomy. And then I think, you know, the sort of climactic ending to this book, the last issue is really all about Peter and Vermin. However, the actions that Craven takes at the end of this story, final in nature, alter the character forever, obviously, and something that I knew it happened because I read summaries of the story before, but it's still a powerful moment. Mm-hmm. You know, when Craven grabs that gun and just to end a major comic like that in 1987 is kind of crazy. Especially a Spider-Man comic, and just really crazy the way to think about how this affects Peter too. Because when Peter finally learns of what's happened, I mean, it's just like it's this moment of he has no idea what's going on. Like, what in the world has happened? And you get the impression that this is an event that Peter will never forget, that he will live with this the rest of his life. This entire harrowing experience of being buried alive, of his enemy who's done all this stuff to him, ultimately absolving him of any blame after all the bad things he did as Spider-Man, and taking his own life, and it's one of those things that I can just imagine being in the moment as these issues are coming out every week in 1987 and how people were reacting to this.
Yeah, I can't imagine. It would be controversial today, you know. So props to Marvel for letting this be published, Nevin. Suicide and mental instability, legitimate mental illness, is not something that is oft addressed in comics, but this one handles it very well, in my opinion.
Indeed so. Also, an interesting thing happens in this book, Nick, in that Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson are married to one another and allowed to be married to one another.
Yes, I know. Remarkable that Marvel got away with that for the better part of 20 years, but and it didn't ruin the character of Spider-Man, although certain individuals at Marvel would probably disagree.
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about enough is the art.
Yeah, yeah.
The artist here is Mike Zeck, and he's a guy that I am not that familiar with. Kind of somehow missed my wheelhouse when I was a kid reading comics. He came to prominence in the 70s as the artist on Master of Kung Fu alongside writer Doug Minch. And later on, he worked on Captain America, did covers for G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero. He actually illustrated Secret Wars, 1984. He was the artist on that. That's where he designed the black. So there you go. He designed the black and white costume that was worn by Spider-Man. He also worked on The Punisher. I mean, he's done pretty much any major Marvel character you can think of. He's done. He also drew the covers for 10 Nights of the Beast and Batman. Worked on Legends of the Dark Knight, Deathstroke, the Terminator, and wrote The Kingdom, Mark Waid's follow-up to Kingdom Come. Sorry, drew it. So he's had a long history, but this is the first Mike Zeck book that I can remember reading, other, I guess, than Secret Wars, which I read when I was a kid, so that hardly counts. I don't remember much. I thought the art was phenomenal in this book. It's very of that mid-80s style of grittiness and griminess,
but it works.
The figures are so detailed. It's great.
And his images of rain-swept cityscapes, that's probably...
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it was perpetually raining in every street level title in the 80s, and yet it kind of works for the story. And
totally,
he does a really good job of depicting that. The cityscapes, then also his sewers. I really like that the sewer settings for the vermin bits.
Yeah.
Everything is bathed in shadow and is gritty and grimy, and yet for this story, you kind of don't want it to be this bright, happy thing. So I thought it was a perfect marriage of story with the art.
I also, one of the things that I loved is that in the midst of making it dark and grimy, the characters don't lose their uniqueness.
Right.
This isn't a case where all the characters look the same. Kraven looks like Peter, who looks nothing like Vermin, who looks nothing like Joe Robertson, who looks nothing like Mary Jane. You know, all the women look distinct. Everyone in this book looked from one another, which it shouldn't be something that we should really notice, but it does stand out because there are a lot of books that you read that it's not the case. And I was just a big fan. You mentioned the cityscapes. Boy, comic books from that era make it seem to me like New York City in the mid-80s was just like rain everywhere and crime everywhere, and you know, but it's great art, outstanding art. The city feels lived in, really feels lived in. I was just a fan of this whole artistic approach to the Spider-Man universe, and it's no secret why one of the reasons that this story is so well revered is Mike Zeck. I would love to see some of his other Spider-Man stuff because he draws him so well. All of the figures in this one, and a lot of nudity for Kraven.
Yeah, a lot of nudity. Lots of nudity.
Now, granted, you don't see any penises, so, you know, DC wouldn't have to pull it off the shelves.
You don't have to cancel the book.
Right. But, you know, with that being said, Nick, I've pretty much run out of superlatives to say about this story.
Me as well.
A lot of times, if we hate something, we talk about it more, which is unfortunate, but there's not much to say about this. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It lives up to its hype. Go and check this out on Marvel Unlimited. Order the trade. Do whatever you have to do to read this book, because it is truly one of the best Spider-Man stories of all time.
Absolutely.
What did you make? What would be your final thoughts on it, Nick? I was interested to get your perspective coming from a different era of Spider-Man, and certainly it was probably a jarring departure in some ways in terms of the tone and everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, I said that at the beginning that it's very different than any Spider-Man story I've ever read. It arguably, you know, when I first started reading, I was like, man, this really feels more like a Batman story, but I wasn't going to complain. But the important part is, by the end, they bring it home and illustrate the differences and how Peter Parker responds differently to a situation like this than somebody like a Batman or a Daredevil or a Punisher, as you said earlier. So, absolutely deserving of it, of its place among the greatest Spider-Man stories of all time. And in terms of these types of stories, these street-level, grittier stories, I haven't read many, but this is easily the best.
Now, begs one more question, Nick, that I have for you, mm-hmm. which is that in, oh, let's say another 50 years, and whenever we do another comic book draft, would you still put J.M. DeMatteis in the comedy box?
Let's not. We're not talking about that. It depends. It's all circumstantial. So you get synergies.
Context is king, right?
That's right.
Or is it content is king? I don't know. One or the other. Nonetheless, that's our review of Kraven's Last Hunt. What a great revelation it was for both of us this month. And we hope you've enjoyed Spider-Month. It's been a good time for us. Let us know your thoughts. We gave you our social media contacts earlier. Tweet us. Come to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, where we'll have this link up at some point. I'm always late posting it. I apologize for that. And also, drop us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Not that we have checked those in ages, but you can always send stuff to
I them. Checked them not long ago for the hard shirt thing.
Yes, very good, very good. So you can email us if you'd like. We just may be delayed in responding. But let us know your thoughts on Kraven's Last Hunt. Where does this rank in your Spider-Man pantheon? Give us your thoughts on that. And with that being said, that's the end of our review of Kraven's Last Hunt. And, you know, I looked at the clock in the ground, and the clock in the ground says 3 o'clock. Mm. Last call for alcohol. Mm. And so
in the ground?
It's actually the clock on the wall in the song, but I didn't decide I was going to reference the song until after I'd already said ground. So, we're going to go with the Wrestling Minute, because there's been a lot going on in the world of wrestling. AEW has announced that a show will debut on TNT Wednesday, October 2nd. Exciting news, Nick.
Absolutely. 2-hour prime time, live from Washington, D.C., big night in wrestling. That is the same week that WWE SmackDown moves to Fox Broadcast Network, you know, getting its, making its major, major debut on a major broadcast network, I should say. So big week in the world of wrestling. And if you believe the rumors, there's a possibility it could be looking at NXT making its debut on FS1 that night, that same night as the AEW show. So early October is going to be a huge, huge week in the old wrestling circles.
Thank God for DVR.
Absolutely.
That's all I can say. And we've also got, of course, the Raw reunion was held this week. Mm-hmm. Nick, I know you were tuning in with particular interest.
Yeah, I fell asleep halfway through, and then I went back and watched the Hulk Hogan segment, and that's all I cared about.
Well, the great Stone Cold Steve Austin helped bring the whole show home. I thought he was the highlight of the show in many ways. He and Bray Wyatt and Mick Foley were the highlights of the show for me. Rest of it, a bit of a snooze fest, but the ending segments were good. Bray and the Stone Cold, Hogan, Flair, all those guys. So Austin can still cut a promo like very few people who have ever lived. And also going on right now is the G1X tournament in New Japan. I have been keeping up pretty closely with it. I think I'm a night behind now. I know, Nick, you're playing catch-up right now. What has been your match of the tournament thus far?
Oh, I haven't watched very many, but probably, oh, God. I'm still going to go Ibushi and Kenta from night one, based on what I've seen.
And I have watched
far more of it than I have.
Through night 7, I haven't watched night 6. I can watch that, and then watch night 8 to catch up. But from what I've seen, I would go Okada and Ospreay from Night 7. I think I told you, Nick, it's one of the best wrestling matches that I've ever seen. So I was completely blown away by it. Anyway, wrestling is awesome. It's going awesome right now. We hope if you are a wrestling fan. And if you're not, check out New Japan's G1 Climax if you're at all interested in sort of the sports presentation of wrestling from back in maybe the Crockett days of the 80s. It's very good.
And that's actually, you talk about a great time to be a wrestling fan, Greg. That's actually a great segue to closing the show the way we normally do. Good old WWE Hall of Famer, good old JR Jim Ross has been helping us out with some musical interludes here, or exits, for some time now. And I know, JR, you've said on your show, there's no better time to be a wrestling fan. Is that right?
Quite frankly, that is correct, yes.
Now, see, one thing that's great about this era of being a wrestling fan is that venues across the country are jumping out to fill it up with wrestling. I mean, even like speaking word venues, for example. Jim, I know you're familiar with our town of Dothan. Near here, they brought in Floyd to speak there at a little venue called Center Stage. We had Ric Flair come and speak at Center Stage.
And I'm going to be there at Fanticon.
Fanticon,
2019.
Absolutely. And so Center Stage has become a really big proponent of the wrestling industry in our area. And so I thought, we need to help promote Center Stage. And so one of the big shows they have coming up here not too far down the road is a little country artist from the late 90s and early 2000s. And so I thought, what better way to promote Center Stage, thank them for promoting the world of wrestling, than to promote their upcoming event. So, Jim, take it away.
Oh, I'm happy to sing this one. This artist is a good and personal friend of mine. I've known him for many years. He's been a guest on my show. Not yet, but he's going to be a guest on my show. Now, this song goes a little something like this. You might recognize it. It's based on an original tune by another friend of mine, Joe Diffie. Familiar with him? Yeah. So he's actually performed, I understand, in Dothan at the Cowboys establishment. Haven't been there myself, but I've heard good stories from Ric Flair over the years. Now, here's how it goes, folks. She cooks with lard, loves hot food bars, a quarter of sweet tea, and fried pork skins. Can't get enough, eats till she's stuffed, goes to the bathroom, then she comes back again. She thinks she looks just like Madonna when she rubs her greasy fingers through her bleach blonde hair. You know what bleach blonde hair stinks? Steve Borden, one of the good men in this business. We recognized him being one of the big parts of that UWF purchase that Crockett made. I knew. I identified him as a top guy. Flair knew it. Everybody knew it. Dusty knew it. And we knew he'd be a big star. And we knew it was over. We just didn't know how over, quite frankly. Most times, she'll place another order, and good God almighty, have mercy on that little bitty chair. She has got a butt bigger than the Beatles. Me out of house and home. Booty size, well, it ought to be illegal, quite frankly. She has a hard time sitting on the throne. And I'm not referring to that throne that Cody Rhodes broke. Real cute, by the way. Taking shots at the competition. We don't need to do that. You never want to punch up or down. You just want to be in your lane. Stay in your lane. For God's sake. Anyway, hamburgers, hot dogs. You know, I got paid in hot dogs. I remember the first show that I refereed paid me in hot dogs and a Coke. And I remember after the show, the promoter walked up to me and he said, for the Coke, that'll be a quarter. Go figure. Cheese fries and coleslaw. A dozen bear claws. Yum, yum, yum. Loves sausage links. Hates diet drinks. Except my diet peach tea from Sonic. Peach tree. What the hell am I talking about, for God's sake? Peach tea from Sonic. What the shit. Takes up seats in a two-seater car. Her doctor told her to lay off the bread. But he didn't say nothing about no Snickers bar. And another all the Snickers bar. Or a Moscow Mule. She drinks Moscow Mules by the gallon. And she'd never eat a salad or a lean cuisine. Then she will lay spread eagle on the hammock. After she has done her damage at the Dairy Queen. She's got a butt that is bigger than the group known as the Big. Folks make fun because she's overgrown. Her rump is shaped like a Volkswagen Beetle. That is also rhymes with the word Beatles. That's why I threw that in there. She gives new meaning to the words big bone. Bagels and cream cheese, vanilla ice cream, a tub of whipped cream. You know, it sounds like I'm just laying out the kind of foods that Paul White was eating in 2000 that, in my opinion, made it difficult for him to get over his top star. I always thought that Paul was very talented. We knew Big Show was great. We just wanted him to be in better shape, better cardiovascular conditioning to allow him to move like the giant that we knew he was. Anyway, you won't find her name on Weight Loss Hall of Fame. Down at Jenny Craig's, when she cleans them out at the Waffle House, they will bring in more ham and eggs, quite frankly. She has got a butt that is bigger than the goddamn Four Horsemen. Her favorite feud is chocolate ding-dongs. You know, did you know, Nick, I don't know if I've ever told you this before, but Jim Herd came up with the concept of the ding-dongs.
Yes.
They're going to have bells on their heads. They're going to be called the ding-dongs. Get it? It's wide enough to play linebacker for the Eagles. Deion Sanders, whose name is spelled wrong on this lyric sheet, boy, better leave her ass alone. Try chicken that's baked or fat-free milkshake. Enough, for God's sake. Stop the insanity. Just stop it. Weight Watchers, oh yeah. Weight Watchers, oh yeah. Oh yeah, I watched her weight. I go from 117 and a quarter when I married her to 317 and a half, 2.5 years later.
Hard traveling fanboys. This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit.
It's true.